saving money in your next project when you shop at Menards. We have everything you need for keeping your outdoor power equipment in tip-top shape. Ensure your lawnmower or boat is running smooth this year. Right now, all FVP lawn and garden and marine batteries are on sale. View our entire selection of FVP batteries today on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer for all of the great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit SimplyScaryPodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. And become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show.
Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Specifically, tonight's episode includes a depiction of suicide. Listener discretion is advised. Well, hello there, listeners. I'm Eric Peabody, and this is the Horror Hill Podcast. Tonight, we're going to be reading a tale from Sam Morris, who we featured a few weeks back with his story Mama, and last season with Hollow. Tonight's story, Them Devils, starts with a good man in a bad place in his life. In a relatively short period of time, Jeremy Smallmouth Bassett has gone from being a college graduate and church deacon to staying at his uncle's remote cabin trying to sober up. Jeremy is managing to make progress, even with his uncle's prolific drinking. One night, Jeremy notices a strange truck speeding down the road, odd for such an out-of-the-way area. When he goes to investigate, he discovers a scene of horror beyond anything he could have imagined. If the gore and violence he witnesses aren't enough, things get worse when he realizes that he has a personal connection to the people involved. You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, and we can scale back some of our less savory means of generating money for the show. By the way, you wouldn't happen to still have all of your organs, would you? And now, from author Sam Morris, I give you Them Devils. On the night when it all happened, a young man called Smallmouth found himself in quite a pickle. He shivered and paced clumsily all over the second-story porch of a cabin that used to be very nice, which overlooked a snowy, downsloping field that used to be kept up properly and carefully. He was already six packs deep into a carton of cigarettes he had bought only 2 days ago from a Casey's General store on his way up. He could recall the look on the young woman's face at the register when he asked for a carton of Parliament menthols, her eyes showing one blink of humorous surprise and another couple blinks of obvious concern which faded to professional indifference as she rang up the sweet, icy killers. Smallmouth stopped his nervous dallying when he caught himself in the kitchen window, a large, shadowy figure sulking between the inside lights and the cold, almost glowing world downhill. His eyes still on his murky reflection, he patted his coat pockets for his seventh pack, pulling it out and smacking it against his left palm before cracking open and lighting it at his mouth. In a slow, warm flash, he could briefly see his own face in the window. "Oh man, it's bad," he thought to himself. He hadn't shaved in weeks, and his beard had grown coarse and thick. A face that his mother had once called handsome had become a clean plate covered in steel wool. Well, maybe not so clean. Under and around his eyes was the obvious bruising of sleeplessness, and his skin had lost its lively color and clarity of yesteryear. He groaned, turning away from the window to look over the porch and into the freezing, beckoning night. The pickle that Jeremy, Smallmouth, Bassett found himself in involved his uncle, and his uncle's evening logistics, to be precise. Smallmouth had been kicked out of his parents' home on December 27th due to a slight misunderstanding at 2 a.m. when he believed the living room Christmas tree to be the downstairs bathroom. He had passed out on the couch after drinking a fire pit full of crushed hams cans, and his brain tried desperately to get him up into the nearby toilet. His little sister Stacy was tucked in, fast asleep on a love seat by the tree, when she was brutally torn from her sugar plum dreams to hear the terrible hiss of Smallmouth's folly. She screamed, the parents woke up, and, well, there you go. After well over three strikes, Smallmouth's temporary residence had come to an end, and he was thrown to his mother's brother's cabin to dry up and straighten out before he could ever even be considered to return.
"You two deserve to live together. He can't say no either because he owes me a lot more than this,"
Smallmouth's mother had screeched over him as he sat at the kitchen table the following morning with a cold bag of peas pressed against his throbbing right temple.
"You go there and you get right. I don't care how long it takes. Just clean up your act and make something of yourself. And for goodness sake, tell Chuck to do the same while he still has time."
Yes, Uncle Chuck had his own shelf full of good time problems, and that's what put Smallmouth in a bind tonight, as he pondered over the white yonder that led to a black nothing. A black nothing that in the daylight pretended to be a forest. At night, it showed its true nature, an endless world of dark secrets and aching regret. At least, that's how Smallmouth saw it in this moment. Chuck had gone down to the ranch he worked on for a New Year's party with his work buddies. They liked to gather at the big barn where all the vehicles and equipment were kept, sitting around a card table, passing out stories about women and other trophy game that were either outright lied about or illegally poached. Oh, and they also liked to pass the bottle around. Therein lied the conundrum for Smallmouth. Uncle Chuck was many things, but one thing he wasn't was a drunk driver. Chuck's wife, Rebecca, had been struck and killed by a drunk driver almost 10 years ago when she was out jogging the back roads early one morning. Everyone assumed that's what led him to his openly hard-drinking and sneakily pill-popping ways in the first place. For Chuck, most nights were kept at home, parked in front of a TV watching old westerns and cleaning out a full bottle of Wild Turkey 101 before snoring in his recliner. On the few nights he would go out, he would always call a ride if things got out of hand. As you can imagine, he tended to need a ride home.
"I should be home about 11:30. Service ain't so good up there near the barn, so if it gets about 11:15, 11:20, and I ain't home, go ahead and do me a favor and come grab me, son,"
Chuck had told Smallmouth before he left, closing the warped screen door behind him. Smallmouth had spent the evening trying his best to stay entertained without the help of any chemical enhancement. His family's anger and resentment really struck him, and this time he was determined to truly get right and get his life back on the rails. He was 29 years old. He had gone through college clean as a whistle, bright and driven, receiving his MBA with plans to work his way up in a promising career in business. That worked for a couple years. Then he found a calling in the ministry, deciding to quit the corporate world to fill an opening of a tiny country church in the area. They needed a deacon who could take care of things around the building and assist in the worship service. He wasn't much for public speaking, having been given the nickname Smallmouth at a young age due to his soft-spoken nature. But he could pass plates and give a hushed prayer every now and then. He liked to mow and paint and help old ladies up the stairs. The quiet country life was really nice for him. For a while. Strange, radical ideas eventually spread through the church, though, and half of its members left overnight to form their own congregation. Its funding cut in half, the church had to close its doors, and the other members absorbed into other churches. Smallmouth rarely ever saw the people that had departed from the church, but rumors creeped that they met in an old abandoned building deep in the woods, performing all sorts of different acts and rituals that would purify themselves and destroy all evils. Nevertheless, Smallmouth was out of work and picked up shifts bartending at a small town dive. His soft fortitude was no match for the booze and drugs and women that would pass through there, and soon he was out the door. That landed him mooching off of his parents, draining their sanity, and eventually draining himself on their Christmas tree. The last strike. So there he was all night, waiting up for Uncle Chuck. He was 2 days clean of everything except caffeine and nicotine, a major improvement. He felt a boost of hope and confidence the first morning after a sober night's sleep. He found the mornings to be the best parts of the day. At least he had coffee and cigarettes to get him out of bed. That would wear off quickly, and the rest of the day was filled with trying to find distractions until the sun set at about 5 p.m. Then he would watch a movie or two with Chuck. Last night he had been able to call it early and go to sleep at 7 p.m., shortly after Chuck started sawing logs in front of True Grit, the original John Wayne version, of course. Tonight, he saw 7 p.m. struggle and churn into 8. 8:13, 8:48, 9:05, 9:29, 9:31, 9:52, 9:58, 10:11, 10:12. Oh, come on. 10:27, 10:56, and finally, 11:08. It was like the clock was a 35-year-old four-cylinder engine oiled with crunchy peanut butter. Now, crunch time sat in the cold air as Smallmouth finished his cigarette and stewed over his decision. He really didn't feel like going down to the barn and getting Chuck, even though it was only a couple miles. In the infancy of his sobriety, he found the smallest of choices and activities to seem dire and, at the very least, upsettingly out of his way. Surely Chuck could get himself home on his own, right? No. Who knows if someone's Aunt Rebecca or grandmother or son is out there on the road tonight, he thought. As much as he had tried to screw up his life, Smallmouth usually knew what the right decision would be, even if he so often refused to listen. It was there, ever so clearly on this New Year's Eve, wailing in the back row of his mind like a misbehaved child during a church sermon. Smallmouth left the porch and went inside to grab his keys. He walked out to his truck, got in, cranked it, let it settle down to 1 RPM, and started down the gravel driveway, which led to the gravel county road that Chuck and his few and far-between neighbors lived on. He got to the mailbox and suddenly shot his attention up the road, where headlights revealed themselves out of the deep dark. It was rare to see any cars this far down Chuck's road. In fact, there were no other houses to the right of Chuck's cabin, spare for a couple of empty ones that were condemned but were attached to a lot of forest property. Smallmouth squinted his eyes as a large black Dodge Ram 3500 came barreling by with a livestock trailer. Even inside his own truck, he could hear a terrible noise coming from that trailer. He recognized it instantly as a pig squeal. "The hell?" he whispered as the truck and trailer tore down the road, going around a nearby corner and out of sight. He couldn't guess what on earth that could be about at this hour, and especially since nobody lived down there anyway. He shrugged it off, though, and turned left out of the driveway, headed for drunk Uncle Chuck down at the ranch. 10 minutes and a couple of snowy country miles later, Smallmouth found himself through the metal gate of the ranch and up to the main barn, where a couple of smiling ranch hands had Chuck held up between them just outside one of the two closed garage doors. A lamppost nearby cast a glow of debauchery on all of their faces, especially Chuck's. Smallmouth got out and walked up to them, smiling and shaking his head.
"Well, well, well," he said with a slight laugh. "Your uncle put on one hell of a clinic tonight, Mouth," one of the hands said.
I don't know what they're talking about, son," Chuck slung out before a high-pitched giggle. "I got another couple of rounds in me, I thinks."
Smallmouth laughed.
"Yeah, I ain't so sure about that, Uncle. Let's get on home now and let these fellas get on too."
All right,"
Chuck said, as Smallmouth took him from his buddy's arms into one of his own and led him to the passenger seat of his truck.
"Happy New Year's, boys. Let's do it all again, okay?"
he hollered to his waving buddies as they drove back away from the barn and through the metal gate toward home.
"You have a good time, Uncle?"
"Oh, I reckon I showed those boys how to do it,"
another childish giggle. A light snow shower seasoned the cold air as the truck rolled down the gravel country road. In the yellow headlights, it made a pleasant white noise for the eyes. Chuck put his hands up, staggered and vertically, fingers together and outstretched, pointing out in front of the truck down the road like he was aiming up for a rifle shot. He closed one eye.
"Straight as an arrow, old son. You're good at this."
"I ain't drunk, Pops,"
Smallmouth chuckled.
"Sure you are. Everybody's drunk, son. Even people that ain't drink. Ticket is to get drunk on good stuff."
Chuck's face calmed from a goofy grin as he kept his eyes out front, pointed into the slow, swirling tube of visible light.
"You sound like you're drunk on some pretty damn good stuff,"
Smallmouth retorted as they shared a look and a good laugh.
"Supposing you ain't wrong. Gotta work on that, just like you are. Proud of you for a couple days clean, man. We'll get right. We'll get right. All I meant was that man's born to get drunk on something or other. What I mean is God. Man is born to get drunk on his God,"
Chuck said, as Smallmouth shot him a raised eyebrow look of confusion.
"Once God gets you drunk, then you're home free, old son. That distillery is never-ending. Eternal. Forever. That land flows with whiskey and honey."
They both shared another laugh.
"Okay, okay. I think I somewhat understand now, Uncle."
They rode for a few seconds in comfortable silence before Chuck put his hands up in an aim position down the road again.
"You know, man has a governor. You know that, right?"
"A what? A governor?"
"That's right, a governor. That's right. A little bitty device in his brain keeps him on the road. Keeps him from turning right off into the dark. You ever hear that little voice that tells you you can turn off into the ditch, into oncoming traffic? Tells you you can shoot your buddy instead of the deer. That you can jump off the top of the building and onto the pavement when you're up there enjoying the view?"
I don't know. I mean, maybe.
Pretty sure those are called intrusive thoughts. They're pretty normal."
"Well, whatever they are, that's what the governor's for. Keeps you straight. Keeps you from harming nothing."
"All right, man, all right."
They pulled back into Chuck's driveway and parked. Smallmouth helped his uncle out of the truck and up into the cabin, snow starting to color the roof and pile against the side of the house near the door. Arms locked, Smallmouth propped open the screen door, opened the inner door, and led Chuck through the kitchen into his bedroom. Chuck laid down on his camo comforter with a deep, long exhale.
"Ah, yes, yes," he whispered with a smile. "I love you, son. I'm glad you're here. Let's get better. Your mom needs it. Stay in the Lord's light, son. Don't let them devils get you. Let's get better. Let's..."
He was off into the distant deep ether almost immediately, and his mouth hung open.
"Good night, Uncle. Love you too."
Smallmouth patted the bed twice before walking over and closing the bedroom door behind him. He went and sat at the kitchen table. He regretted his behavior earlier in the night, how it pained him to have to stay up a little later to go help out his uncle. "Come on," he whispered. He agreed with Chuck. He was here to get better, to do better. Maybe Chuck was right. If he couldn't get drunk off booze, it was time to pick something else to drink. Better things. Maybe even God? Smallmouth hadn't paid much mind to God since his church job fell through. God surely hadn't been there for him these last few years when he was at his lowest. Or was he there the whole time? Had Smallmouth just ignored him? These things floated heavily in his mind, and soon he realized he had been staring at the front door for several minutes. Had he even blinked? Then something else came to mind. Wait, hold up. That truck and trailer from earlier. What was that? He meant to bring it up to the ranch hands. They would have seen it come barreling down the road right by their front gate. He wished he had brought that up to them. Oh well, it was probably nothing. Smallmouth looked at the clock. 12:12. Happy New Year, old boy, he said to himself. He sat for a moment in the warm kitchen light, his eyes not leaving the front door. Well, he was up this late already. Why not go run down and check on the abandoned properties? No, it can wait. It's probably nothing, right? Wrong. There's that wailing kid in the back pew of his mind again. Come on, kid, can't you just be quiet and listen to the sermon? No, it couldn't. It must be heard. Always. He knew he had to go check it out. Fine. Smallmouth got up and grabbed his truck keys, patted to make sure his cigarettes were still there, and was out the door again. The snow shower had ended. As he pulled up to the edge of the drive, he stalled for a moment and peeked out as far to the right as he could down the dark road. Nothing. It wasn't very far to the end of that road, where two out-of-service mailboxes should have stood in a small cul-de-sac if it weren't for teenagers beating them to splinters. Can't really blame them either. Smallmouth considered his plan. Whether or not that truck belonged to the landowner down there, he shouldn't feel like he needed to sneak around. He was merely a concerned neighbor, after all. He began down the road and around that same corner the stranger disappeared around earlier. After a couple of slow, curious minutes, Smallmouth could see the evidence of a great big fire in the near distance, beyond where the road ended. Through the bare trees and against the snow, it cast orange and red that could surely be seen a mile in every direction. That is, if there were anyone there to see it. Slightly intimidated, Smallmouth decided to turn off his headlights and let the fire guide him as he slowed down to 5 miles per hour and gently crackled his last few yards of gravel up to the remnants of the nearest mailbox post. It seemed the fire was on the land of the farther property, whose mailbox post hole was about 30 feet from where he came to a stop and parked his truck. Smallmouth turned it off and quietly got out into the cold. He crouched down as he walked over to the farther driveway, getting down on one knee to give it a stealthy, closer look. The abandoned property boasted a busted-up trailer that sat pitifully about 500 feet from the mailbox memorial. Beyond that was a good 10 acres of field that ended at the forest edge, which marked the beginning of thousands of acres of wildlife refuge. As Smallmouth peered in, it was obvious that the fire was way out in that field, blocked by the old trailer, which wore the hot light and columns of smoke on it like a devilish crown. Given the cover, Smallmouth crept over to the trailer and started easing around the right side. Rounding the corner, he noticed a propane tank that would be perfect for hiding behind and getting the best look he could at the mysterious activity. He got down on his belly and crawled his way over to the tank before sitting up and peeking slowly over the top and out into the field. Way down there, a couple acres away from the tree line, was a huge fire made up of about 50 wooden pallets. It raged and lit up the whole field like it was just the beginning of sunset. Somewhat near the fire was the black Dodge Ram 3500 and trailer. Smallmouth could see a group of people dressed in all red, as if covered in bloody bedsheets from head to toe, circled around a crude cage, seemingly fastened together by pieces of metal fencing. They stood still as the pines and twice as silent. Smallmouth, in a rare moment of curious courage, decided he had to get closer. He got back on his stomach and began to crawl through the cold, knee-high grass. Using the firelight as his north star, he crawled and crawled, feeling his hands, clothes, and beard get wet with snow. He didn't care. Something was up that wasn't normal, wasn't right. He could feel it in his cold gut. When he thought he was close enough without giving himself away, he planted his palms and ever so slowly raised his torso up into a weak push-up to try and see out. He was glad he didn't go any further. He may have been too close already. He was close enough to read the name of the truck and count the holes in the livestock trailer. There were seven strangers in red sheets all around the makeshift cage, all holding long spears. One of the figures had a crown of black thorns on his head. They all had two eye holes and one hole for the mouth. They didn't move a muscle for the longest time before the crowned one forcibly touched the end of his spear to the ground.
"Now is the time, brother and Farmer Abraham. There's no more for us in waiting."
Smallmouth had just noticed the passenger window to the black Dodge was down, and he could hear the driver door open and soon saw a normal-looking older man in a ball cap at the back of the trailer. He was holding a leash of some sort. He opened up the trailer and whistled into the dark of it. After a couple of loud, heavy thuds, a gigantic Yorkshire pig came slowly shrugging out of the trailer. It was light pink in color, but filthy, and gave wet-sounding oinks as it came to the man's hands expecting food. The thing must have weighed 1,500 pounds and was at least 10 feet long. It actually had to lower its head to reach the man's hands, its ears coming up to the man's chest. Smallmouth couldn't believe his eyes. The man reached into his pocket and revealed a handful of some type of feed, which he tossed on the ground at the pig. It started right in, as the man fixed a collar on the pig's girthy neck, then attached a leash. The pig gave a slight squeal.
"Good girl, good girl. Come on now."
The man called Farmer Abraham sweetly coaxed the animal. He gave his end of the leash a tug, and the monstrous swine reluctantly left its food and followed the man over close to the crowned one. The fire raged and raged nearby, throwing crazy shadows all over the place.
"What have you brought us, brother and Farmer Abraham?"
"Yeah, this is old Azazel. She's been in my family for years, man."
The crowned one dropped his spear and knelt down to the jowls of the hog, the dark holes of his eyes meeting those of the animal. The other red-cloaked figures remained statuesque around the cage.
"Ah, yes, old Azazel. Hello. You are to be of great importance in the history of the earth tonight, old friend."
The crowned one got back up to address brother and Farmer Abraham, who seemed obviously put off, yet submissive.
"And is this old Azazel a natural specimen? Is it fed only of the earth and the filths therein?"
Yes, sir, I'd reckon so."
"This is necessary for a proper sacrifice, brother and Farmer Abraham. You may only bring your best, your cleanest, your most dear to the altar of the Almighty."
"I understand. May I take her now?"
The farmer gave his end of the leash to the black-gloved left hand of the crowned one. The crowned one stood with it for almost a full minute in total stillness and silence. The only noise Smallmouth could hear was the sloppy smacks and oinks from old Azazel. The farmer anxiously waited, wringing his hands, expecting the next move from the crowned one.
"Turn away, brother and Farmer Abraham. Turn away from us and toward the fire now,"
the crowned one finally spoke.
"Phew, all right. We're still good on our deal? You still promise to make my little girl better, like you said?"
the farmer asked with some hopeful desperation.
"Turn now."
"Well, okay."
The farmer turned his back to the crowned one and toward the fire.
I can assure you, with all of the knowledge in my mind and in my heart, you will never see your daughter sick again in this lifetime, Brother and Farmer Abraham. You may find peace and solace in this truth." The farmer nodded in relief as he looked upon the fire. Smallmouth, taking it all in with great confusion, could see a smile on the farmer's fire-lit face, and turned back to the crowned one, just in time to see him reach under his red garment and pull out a pistol and shoot a round into the back of the farmer's head, blowing his cap off, which frisbeed down near his shaking, crumpled body. Old Azazel threw a fit immediately, screaming and trying her best to flee. The crowned one held the immense beast with one hand and with seemingly little effort. The other red-clothed figures finally made noise, laughing deep and heartily around the cage. The crowned one, keeping old Azazel close, walked over to the doubled-over farmer, putting two more bullets into his head, essentially hollowing it out into a carnal mess. The farmer's shaking mercifully stopped. Smallmouth had to slam his forearm up to his mouth to muffle the scream that would have come out and blown his cover. His eyes were flown wide open and his arms were shivering. The crowned one put the pistol back under his red cloak and led the great pig, still squealing, as high-pitched and piercing as the human ear could withstand, over to the mouth of the cage, which was opened by the nearest red-clothed stranger. Old Azazel flew into the cage, having been unleashed by the crowned one. It struggled around the cage, which was no bigger than 15 by 15 feet, giving it no room to get comfortable. It circled the inner perimeter, showing impressive speed for such a large animal. It squealed and squealed. The sound stung Smallmouth's ears, and he covered them with his hands. He was still out of sight in the tall grass. The red people around the cage laughed at the hog's entrapment. The crowned one raised a hand to signal silence. The red people were still and quiet again. "Now, my brothers, the sacrificial gift is in our possession. Tonight is a holy night." The crowned one raised his voice as if getting to the climax of a fire and brimstone sermon. "Tonight, we will destroy what was once cast out, but never vanquished. We will rid the earth of a great army, an army of hell that has far too long roamed and sickened our lands and killed our loves. Tonight, we will destroy the destroyers, the legion of Satan's soldiers born just after the Garden of Eden fell." The crowned one fell to his knees, his arms up and stretched toward the frozen sky. A mighty wind began blowing at Smallmouth's back. He had to lower his head as it roared over him. After a moment, it calmed, and he was able to lift up again to see. Winds from all corners of the field met at the cage, swirling over it in a great snowy funnel that led up to the clouds. Old Azazel screamed and screamed from the cage. "I see you, villains! I hear you, hosts of hell! I know you live in these trees! I know you cower within the sound of my voice! Show yourself! Take the body of this animal that I have set before you! Take it now! Take it now and face me! Take it now! Take it now! Take it!" The crowned one's vocal cord shredding performance was cut short by a single burst of black lightning that shot down from the middle of the snowy funnel cloud that surrounded the cage. The crowned one and all the red people were thrown several feet back from the blast. Thunder immediately exploded across the field. Smallmouth buried his face as the force and sound raced over him. Ears ringing, he kept his face down for a few seconds. Then he squinted back up to the strike zone. The strange black lightning had blown the cage completely apart. Two of the red people had been hit with the metal fencing. One laid motionless. The other gargled in pain as he put a hand to the pole that was sticking out of his sternum, having penetrated all the way through. His legs buckled and he fell forward, the end of the pole hitting the ground first and propping him up for a moment, before his body slowly slid down to the ground around the metal. He went silent. The other four red people, yelling in surprise, gathered themselves, looking to the charred hole in the ground where old Azazel should be,
right in the center where the cage used to stand. The crowned one got to his feet and picked up his spear.
"My brothers, gather your arms,"
the crowned one whispered, breathing heavily under his red cloak.
"The work is not over."
The four remaining red people grabbed their spears and slowly walked over to the burnt, smoking hole, holding an attack pose over it until further instructions were given.
"Are you with us, you age-old tormentors?"
This was the first time Smallmouth could hear fear in the tired voice of the crowned one.
"Are you with us now? Are you ready to die, you infernal bastards? Are you ready to..."
The crowned one was interrupted by a booming noise from the hole that tore Smallmouth's wits to shreds. It was similar to the cry of old Azazel, but much deeper and 10 times louder and angrier. It was as if a freight train was blaring its horn and slamming its brakes at the same time.
"Now, my brothers, strike the beast of hell with your spears! Now!"
The red people all threw their weapons down into the smoking hole. The hellish noise from within stopped in an instant. The red people crowded closer to the edge of the hole, waiting for the smoke to clear. The crowned one walked over to them, putting his black-gloved hand on the shoulder of the nearest man.
"Oh, brothers, oh my dear, dear brothers, your acts tonight have rid the earth of a great and powerful evil."
Before he could continue, a fully enraged and re-inspired bellow thrust itself up and out of the hole like a serrated blade, much, much louder and angrier than before. The red people were taken aback in terror. Suddenly, from within the hole, a large head emerged and gaped a huge, disgusting maw up at the crowd. The head was burned black, and its eyes were half-boiled white and without pupils. It shrieked out that most terrible noise as if it didn't need oxygen.
"There's no way,"
Smallmouth heard himself say under his breath. All in one motion, the beast leapt out of the hole and turned to face its attackers. It was old Azazel, except swollen with burnt mass. It appeared to have grown a half a size at least. 3 spears stuck out of its sizzling, charcoal-colored back. It snapped its gigantic jaws at the red people, who shuddered in horror. The crowned one spoke.
"Do not relent, brothers! Attack! Attack the brute!"
He pulled his pistol back out of his cloak and fired the remaining 3 rounds on the new and horribly black-burnt old Azazel. The beast's cloudy, boiled-egg eyes shot open along with its unnaturally stretched jaws. It took the 3 bullets as if they were tennis balls. At the speed of a charging grizzly and with multiple times the power, old Azazel raged over to the crowned one and dove onto him mouth first, putting both front hooves on his chest as he was knocked down. The crowned one cried out in a shockingly high-pitched wail, like a man being electrocuted. The beast bit right into the soft of his belly and began to shake him around like an orca trying to separate a seal from its pelt.
"Oh, God! Oh, God! Oh, help me! No! Oh, God, help me! Mama! Oh, Mama!"
The beast ate and ate and shook and shook and tore and broke and destroyed, while the crowned one lost more and more of his body, all while crying out to the sky at the top of his punctured lungs. The other red people sprinted to the black Dodge Ram, opened its doors, and piled inside. Smallmouth heard it crank up, and it began to speedily turn around and race away from the fire and back toward the road. The beast unhooked from the crowned one and let out another ghastly roar of victory before biting into his neck, ending his screaming forever. The beast then left his half-devoured body and began a tremendous and terrible charge after the truck, which was greatly slowed down by the trailer. Smallmouth put his face down as the beast passed over him by only about 10 feet on its way to the truck, which had just made it back to the road and was using every RPM possible to get away from the demon-charged killing machine on its heels. Smallmouth turned around to watch both parties disappear down the road, the echoes of that great and evil blasting noise stabbing his ears again.
He remained on his stomach in the tall, snowy grass for another 2 minutes as he normalized his breath and tried to make any sense of what he had just witnessed. Eventually, he slowly rose up and looked to make sure that terrible thing was indeed out of the area. No signs of life or death from up at the road. The danger was at least a couple miles away by now. Smallmouth then turned back toward the fire and to the dominated body of the crowned one. He carefully walked up, closer and closer. To his amazement, he heard wheezy noises coming from the emptied-out torso of the man, a scattering of insides and flesh and blood strewn all around him. Troubled, rattling breaths escaped from under the red-clothed head, whose crown of thorns had flown off in the attack. Most of the red cloak had been ripped to shreds, and all that remained covered were his shoulders and above. The cloth slowly ebbed and flowed with breath. Smallmouth couldn't believe this man was still alive. His entire digestive system was eviscerated, and his ribs were exposed. Smallmouth knelt down beside him and lifted his cloak over his head to let him at least breathe his last in the open air. Smallmouth let out a gasp. This man had a face that Smallmouth knew very well. He recognized him immediately from the old church he worked at. The clean-shaven face, the short silver hair, the sharp nose. This was a man that had joined his church 2 weeks before the schism. He never spoke in church, but it was rumored he would meet at the homes of different members and try to sway them to his strange ideas. He was the one rumored to have led the radical faction somewhere in the middle of the woods. To Smallmouth, it was all starting to make more sense. "I know you," Smallmouth said softly. "I know who you are. You tore a church in half, didn't you? You're the crazy guy that split up my old church. What the hell have you done?" The man struggled to breathe and tried his best to spit up a couple of words. His neck had deep lacerations that flowed with escaping life.
I only did what I believed,
he whispered before a wet, stifled breath.
What did you do?
Smallmouth grew angry, and his voice followed suit. This man had ruined his job, and now he had unleashed something horrifying on his neighborhood. He had tampered with things that man has no business tampering with.
I've failed, Smallmouth Bassett,
the man croaked. Smallmouth couldn't believe he had bothered to remember his name.
I've failed. God help you all.
With that, the man's face fell, and he let out one last slow exhale before all was still. Smallmouth got back on his feet and looked away from the dead man and toward the fire, which towered and raged in the reflection of his eyes.
Oh no! Oh no! Oh no!
He said in between terrified breaths. Then another thought hit him like a wrecking ball.
Uncle Chuck!
Scott Masterson had first met Scarlett at a rooftop party in downtown Dallas. Their age and the time of year were both in late springtime, them in their mid-20s and the date in early May. He had on a sharp yet breezy blazer, and she astonished in a thigh-length sleeveless blue dress.
"Oh, hey, Scott, I don't believe you two have met,"
his then-happily married friend had remarked with a slow, swinging open hand toward her.
"Scott Masterson, reluctant friend to this knucklehead," he said with a tight-lipped grin, trying not to be so obvious with his instant rapture.
"Scarlett, a pleasure."
Her hand was so delicate to Scott's touch. They locked eyes. It was like looking back through centuries of connection. Endless days of laying in the sun next to the Seine River, or rising to Hollywood fame in the 1940s and only having each other who would understand the glory and the pain of it all. Or generations of quiet, simple, country love that would bear such beautiful, happy children that would go on to raise beautiful, happy children, all with their dark blue eyes.
Yes, the memories of every love story since the beginning of time were swirling right there in Scarlet's irises. Scott had to catch himself before he stared embarrassingly too long.
"Sorry, Scotty here doesn't get out too often," his friend quipped, which Scott appreciated, actually. It helped him snap back to professionalism.
"Well, I don't either. At least, I prefer not to."
Scarlet's words flowed through the air like a flock of rose petals.
"Hey, kindred spirits."
Scott was really sensing a rising energy out of her. They had barely broken eye contact.
"Well, I'll let you two have at it. I got a wife around here somewhere."
"Hey, Scott and Scarlet. Not bad. Not bad."
His friend exited stage right with a sly chuckle.
"Nice guy. So, what are you drinking, Scarlet?"
Scott looked around for the emptiest corner of the rooftop bar, hoping to find a nice place for them to be able to hear each other. This night had just become something.
"That depends, Scott. What do you like?"
"Oh, man."
Well, as you can expect, the evening blossomed into a beautiful, long-winded conversation that etched a long list of similarities between the two. They both lived in the same city, had never married, and had dreamed of stable, simpler lives far away from tall buildings and busy streets. The next morning, Scott awoke in her arms, which warmed much deeper than just his skin. He could feel her soothing his very identity, his future, everything. Her arms were tailor-made to fit his very soul, and he had never felt more safe and at home.
You can stay right here," she whispered, eyes still closed.
"I will, I will."
They both fell back asleep, into a dream that wouldn't end upon waking. 2 years passed, and suddenly they lived that simple backwoods life, way out where acres of land far outpopulated the few and far between people. They took a lovely home, which happily looked over a long backyard, right up to a lively yet mostly undisturbed river. Their only neighbor within a mile was an older ranch worker named Charles, who rarely made himself perceivable. Days were spent way on into town where they both had offices. They didn't mind the commute. Nights were spent mostly like this night, cuddled outside near a lovely little fire with a slowly shrinking amount of wine sitting between them, enjoying their kingdom. Tonight, however, would prove to be a special night for many reasons, all unexpected.
"Honey, I've been thinking," Scott began, sitting up and opening his hands to the warmth of the fire.
"Oh?" Scarlet also sat up, eyes widening.
"So, look, Scarlet, the last 2 years have been the best of my life, an absolute dream."
She held her breath, her focus darting between his eyes and mouth.
"Yeah?"
"We have everything we ever want out here. But what if there's more?"
"More?"
She had envisioned this very conversation hundreds of times.
"Our dreams have come true, but what if we made some new dreams?"
Scott turned and embedded his eyes into hers. He burst into a big smile.
"Scott, I thought..."
"Never mind what I said,"
he cut her off, which he always made a point to never do, but this was a good exception.
"I'm ready, Scarlet. Let's have a family."
"Oh, Scott. Oh, Scott."
They hugged tight enough to where it hurt.
"Well, in that case, we may need to open another bottle,"
she said playfully, bouncing her eyebrows twice.
"Excellent. I'll be right up. I'll put this fire out, and then start yours up."
"Oh, stop."
She bounded away girlishly, up the snowy back steps and into the house. Scott let out a big sigh that he could see in the cold air and sat back in his chair, taking in his decision. He really was ready. He had secretly been keeping a long list of names that he liked and that he thought would work in front of Masterson, especially little girl names. He stared into the campfire flames, getting lost imagining the three of them sitting right here, a little girl resting securely in Scarlet's arms, as Scott had found himself and stayed within these past 2 years. Suddenly, his trance was broken when, from the road in front of their house, came the sound of a vehicle approaching at high speed. Scott snapped his head back toward the house to get a better listen.
He could see, around the house and through the trees, a large truck barreling down the country road, its headlights racing and bouncing with intensity. In an instant, it had passed up the road and out of sight. Huh. Soon, after a moment of silence, another sound echoed into the night. This sound rattled Scott to the bone and tore all that was right in his world into pieces. A sharp, bellowing squeal. His eyes shot over to his neighbor's house, which was about a tenth of a mile to his right, but still had a couple dim lights on that he could see. The shriek seemed to come from there. Then, more squeals. It was hellish. More than animal, but not quite human. Scott stood up. He heard crashing and tearing and further destruction coming from Charles's house.
"Scarlet! Scarlet!"
he yelled toward his house, where he looked and could see her silhouette behind the curtains at the kitchen window. She didn't seem to hear him. He turned back toward his neighbors. The chaos had gone quiet. Not a half moment after, though, he heard something big barreling through the trees as fast as that truck had been sprinting. Running furiously between the two houses. Searching. Hunting. Scott was taken aback so hard that his heel had caught the edge of the fire pit, throwing him down only inches away from severe burns. He had knocked his head in the whiplash, making him groan and take a moment to regain his bearings.
"Scarlet!"
he screamed out toward his home as he sat up, rubbing a quickly rising bump on the back of his head. He heard a loud breaching on the side of his house, the patio door.
"No, no!"
Then, all hell broke loose. Scarlet started wailing and crying, and he could hear crashes of plates and glasses and deep, guttural roars coming from the kitchen inside. Shadows danced in a frenzy from the curtained windows. Sounds of instinctual survival seemed to be thrown from Scarlet inside. Sounds of defeat. Sounds of agony. Sounds of insanity. Scott sprang to his feet, his equilibrium being more damaged than he realized after his fall. He had to catch his hand on a chair to stabilize himself. Scarlet's symphony of pain had gone quiet. Soon after, something burst back out the patio door again and off in the same direction as that truck before. Scott struggled back up to the house, slowly climbing the wintered, crunching stairs that led to the patio. He no longer yelled for Scarlet. In fact, the only thing that came to his senses was the sound of his own heavy breathing. Everything else had been turned off, save for a heavy and sudden dread that he had prayed he would never feel. He came to the side of his house, where, indeed, the patio door had been busted and forced open. It laid inside the kitchen, its hinges snapped like toothpicks. Scott, with eyes wide and twitching, slowly entered his home and looked into the kitchen. He didn't scream. He didn't even change his breathing. He didn't blink. He just got a good long look at what laid before him. Everything was broken. The fridge was on its side, the door hanging open, and food and drinks scattered all over the floor. The table was upended, its legs to the ceiling. A chair was resting on the counter, possibly having been thrown in self-defense. And Scarlet, oh, Scarlet, she was everywhere. She was all over the floor. She was sprayed against the walls. She was stuck to the window. She was in the sink. Scott gently walked through the carnal mess and sabotage of his world. Long ago, he had known exactly what he would do if something anywhere near this bad were to happen to him. He politely stumbled through the kitchen, down the hall, and into the bedroom. He opened his closet door and lowered a fire safe from the top rack. He unlocked it with a passcode, 511, after that warm May date when he had first met Scarlet. In the safe was a Sig Sauer P320 handgun. Scott took it out, along with a box of bullets, loaded one into the gun, put the safe back on its rack, and walked out of the closet, sitting on his bed. Their bed, where they should have been laying right at this very moment, working toward a happy future, where he would have kissed her forehead and put a hand on her growing midsection, where they would have awoken on Christmas morning to the sound of children who were way too excited to remain asleep, where they would have grown old, where they would have smiled at each other through wrinkles, satisfied with all the love they shared and passed on to the next generations, where they would have held each other in deep peace as they finally fell asleep to this world. I will. In one quick motion, Scott pulled back the hammer and stuck the barrel of that pistol right up against his governor and blew himself away, far away, right back into Scarlett's loving arms. Jeremy Smallmouth Bassett quickly yet stealthily made his way back to his uncle's house. He hugged the sides of the dark country road, keeping his eyes and ears wide open as to notice any sounds pertaining to the event that he had just witnessed there in the field next to the huge blaze. His only thought was Uncle Chuck. His house was right on the warpath of that horrible thing, and Smallmouth had to go to him and make sure he was safe. He dared not go back to his truck, which would bring a lot of unwanted attention. No, Smallmouth walked and walked, and finally saw the light of his uncle's house. He carefully approached the front door from the shadowed driveway. Suddenly, it occurred to Smallmouth that something was very wrong here. The door was busted in, having been plowed through by something very large and very strong. No, no, no. Smallmouth slowly entered the house. The kitchen and living room were a disaster, chairs and tables and bottles strewn about and shattered. Bloody hoof prints covered the floors, each of them the size of dinner plates. Smallmouth heard no noise. He felt himself well with tears, his nose a faucet that he began to sniff up as he worked his way through to his uncle's room, the door there also being broken in. A small whine growing in his throat, Smallmouth peeked into his uncle's bedroom. It was all in tatters. The bed had been attacked and shredded, the mattress being ripped up and thrown about as if it were made of cotton candy. More bloody hoof prints were painted all over the brown carpet. Smallmouth trembled and put a hand up to his wet face. He didn't see a way that his uncle was anywhere near alive, knowing what he knew about the monster that had been in this house. Smallmouth slowly walked to the living room, to the only little table that had been untouched in the attack. It was almost as if the bottle of whiskey teleported into his hand from the overturned cabinet, unopened. He fixed that real quick. Soon, he was several pulls deep of the only thing in the world that he knew would make him feel better, even if only for a few hours. He found his pack of cigarettes in his coat pocket and lit one up, although he was indoors. What did it matter? He sat in a chair that he had turned right side up and set the bottle on the table and looked out the back window into the pitch black. He cried for his uncle, and he cried for the world. He cried for himself. He cried for broken promises and his own weakness. He drank and drank until his vision shook from right to left everywhere he looked. At first, he didn't even notice the figures on the back porch. Then his vibrating focus did pick up on them, but by then it was too late. It was so dark out there, but in their outlines he could see they wore long robes and hoods.
Ha! Come and get me! You come and get me!
Smallmouth boasted with a delusional amount of courage. A creaking sound escaped from the kitchen, and he drunkenly swung his head over toward it. Three more figures stood there. Or was it just one? Smallmouth was none the wiser. All at once, the hooded intruders from both inside and outside began to chant a strange, twisted rhyme in strikingly low and dissonant harmony. A sliver of liver goes down with a shiver, and gives your gullet to gall. But drink the cider that drowns the spider, and you will be free of it all. So tighten the grip that loosens your lips. Oh, raise the bottle of brown, and wake tomorrow to find, in sorrow, another spider to drown. Smallmouth groaned at them in dissatisfaction and turned his bottle up again and began to chug the whiskey. As he did, they repeated the chant, except this time it was louder and closer. By the time Smallmouth had finished his bottle, he was quickly losing consciousness. This wasn't just whiskey. As he closed his eyes, he felt hands grabbing him from all sides. Smallmouth pulled open his sticky eyelids. His head felt like someone had bowled a strike into it. Wind froze his face. The smell of sickly, wet iron stung his nostrils. His vantage was higher than usual, way higher. He was looking out into another field, but from easily 10 feet up. He saw an old church, formerly painted white, but now a flaky, pale beige. He heard the friction of a quick pull of rope below him, matched with a slight, tight pain at his feet. He looked down. A red-robed figure was fastening him against a wooden structure of some kind. His feet sat on a small, flat platform perpendicular to a post that went from the ground up past Smallmouth's head. He couldn't move his arms, so he quickly shot his eyes side to side. They were also tied to another horizontal post. A cross. He was being tied to a crude wooden cross. His shirt had been removed, exposing a hairy, overweight belly. Smallmouth tried to speak, but all that came out was a slow, unintelligible grumble. He was still drunk. No, this was more than that. He was under the influence of something strong and absolutely inhibitive. He wallowed again and took in a deep breath. The smell of iron once again hit his nose. He looked down at himself. He was covered in a thick, red liquid. That wasn't just the smell of iron. He had been splashed full body with blood.
"Now, now, young servant." The figure at his feet had finished his task and took a couple of steps out to admire his own handiwork.
"Ah, perfect. The picture of martyrdom. Yes, you will always be remembered, Brother Bassett. You are to be the first saint of the new Bible."
He opened his arms in his declaration. Smallmouth looked up into the cold night sky. The moon shone down, giving everything a midnight spotlight. It was a gorgeous waxing gibbous, big and bright, but not quite full. Yes, he was in a great big snowy field that housed an old worn-down church. From the windows of the church, he saw candles glowing, showing dark heads and shoulders looking out to him, also covered in loose hoods, hiding faces. He was hanging on a cross about 100 feet from the old church. In front of the cross was a partially covered pit, a couple of 2x4s supporting double armfuls of branches and dead leaves. The figure at the base of the cross put his arms back to his sides. He was still looking right at the drugged Smallmouth's dumbstruck face. Even with a veiled mouth, Smallmouth could hear the twisted smile in his voice.
"Tonight, you will help us finally defeat this legion, Smallmouth. You see, it may have the evil spirits within it, but at its core, it is still an owned animal. An animal that knows its master very well. An animal that will remember the smell of its master. You, my friend, are covered in its master right now, and you're hanging on a cross, the symbol of this brute's most hated enemy. But take heart, young brother. Before you is our pit of spears. Yes, you will attract the beast, but our divine plan will intercept it, and the beast will fall and be pierced. And then, oh dear brother, you will forever be immortalized. You will be purified in fire by the hands of your church brethren. Out of your screams and into the smoke,
the iniquities of all will be released. We will go on to preach your good example and your sainthood forever and ever." Smallmouth began to drool and hum pathetically. He could hear and understand the words of the robed man, but he couldn't fight back. His body was useless, limp inside its rope confines. All he could do now was think and watch and wait and dread his fate. The figure turned away from him, walking over near the pit and gathering up a bundle of brambles and throwing them over the last open area, covering it completely. He then crunched through the snow over to the front door of the old church, groaning open the door. He stood at the dark doorway for a few seconds in silence, and then began to make a noise. An over-exaggerated pig-squealing noise, high-pitched and infuriating. Soon after, other voices from inside the church began to do the same, their wailing echoing out of the building and all across the field, loudly signaling, calling out. It may as well have been a dinner bell. Not a half minute after they began the distress signal, it was loudly answered by a distant squall. A furious squall. This was it. Either way it happened, Smallmouth was about to die. Experience terror and then die, and not even have the ability to put up any kind of defense. It wasn't fair. He just slowly lifted up his head and watched out far into the moonlit white field. He then raised his heavy head further and took a good gander at the moon and stars for the last time. God, he thought to himself, still having full inner monologue yet no outer motor function. I am so sorry. I'm so sorry for being what I am. I'm so sorry for ending up in this place. It's only my own fault. If it wasn't for me being so stupid and messy and drunk and terrible, then this wouldn't be happening to me. He began to shed tears that washed lines into the blood on his face. Please forgive me, God. Please, please, please forgive me for all my sins. This is it. I'm gonna die. I'm gonna die. Please forgive me. He yelled inside his own mind, hoping and trying to send his silent words as far up into heaven as they could go. He lowered his eyes back to the ground. He looked over at the church again. The windows were empty. The candles were extinguished. Those hooded cowards were hiding from their own handmade sacrificial service. All was quiet for a long pause, until a much louder, closer bleating began at the edge of the forest, not even 300 feet away from Smallmouth's glazed-over eyes. It was time, and it was too late for a miracle. Out of the woods, slowly and heavily, stomped the massive hog. As it marched closer and closer, Smallmouth could see its white, boiled-over eyes and black burnt skin. Its jaws were flying open and snapping its sharp, pocket-knife-sized teeth together in an intimidating clack. It was now less than 100 feet away, the dark old church to its right shoulder. It stopped, its pale, glowing eyes fixed right on Smallmouth on the crude cross. It truly was a monster. It stood as tall as a man and as long as a canoe. Around its murderous mouth were stains of red, the remnants of all that it had taken from the world on this unholy night. In its clanging jaws were bits of flesh. It snorted and scowled. Then, in a fury, it wailed that horrible squeal and started off into a dead sprint. It galloped and galloped toward Smallmouth at a high, blistering speed. It kept yawping and howling as it cut the distance from the cross down to 50 feet, 40 feet, 30, 20. All at once, it passed over the covered pit and plunged in. In his doomed, dead-eyed stupor, Smallmouth could hear what sounded like paint being dumped from a rooftop onto concrete. Trails of black liquid squirted and splashed up from the pit, which had been uncovered in the fall of the beast. Unbelieving, Smallmouth saw dozens of steel spear tips standing up from the dug-in ground. right in the middle of them. The beast was stuck. The sheer weight of the animal had caused the spears to pierce through its tough skin, sticking out of its back, soaked in black blood. One spear had stabbed right under the hog's chin, passing up through its jaws and out its black snout. It made agonized sounds. It roared and roared and shook the spears inside it, beginning furiously, then growing weaker and weaker within seconds. Finally, it let out one last weak little squeal before it went still and quiet. Smallmouth was frozen both physically by drugs and constraints and mentally by shock. His mouth hung open toward the pit of spears, his vision blurry. He took in a deep, troubled breath and let out a moan of disbelief and relief. The old church doors sprang open, and the sound of jubilation within flowed out into the night. The red-robed figures flocked out of the building toward the pit, arms raised in celebration. They surrounded the hole, getting a good look at their success and their enemy's defeat. Some held additional spears and began further stabbing the dead animal, causing more black blood to be shed up at them. They all yelled loudly and triumphantly. Some danced around the pit. Some skipped over to Smallmouth on the cross and danced around him, slapping his legs and spinning in circles. Smallmouth looked on at the raucous celebration, both in utter disbelief that their trap actually worked, and also in turmoil. How long now until they fully executed their plan? A taller robed man, whose voice matched the same one who spoke to Smallmouth as he tied his feet, spoke up, sounding almost happily intoxicated.
Ah, yes, my brothers, it is done! We have won!
They all whooped and cheered.
Brother Norman, go into the church and bring me the small tank of fuel. Let us send our dear Saint Basset to the Holy Lands, where he will be adored for all eternity.
They all clapped and hollered. One figure began childishly skipping away from the pit and over toward the front door of the church. Then, it happened. From the pit, all of a sudden, a great blaze erupted instantly. It stood as tall as the cross, and it burned a furious red and blue. It raged and raged, blinding Smallmouth and making him clumsily turn his face away from the heat. All of the figures panicked, screaming and scattering away toward the church. They didn't get far. Up from the fiery pit, dozens of long, long black arms, adorned with six hooking claws, emerged and stretched out of the flames and latched on to the legs of those trying to escape. Smallmouth heard crying and wailing from the men as the black, razor-clawed hands of the Legion grabbed them and began pulling them back into the blazes. One by one, the red-robed people were dragged into the flames, their clothes catching instantly. Smallmouth could see violently shaking bodies in the evil furnace. Oh, the screams. Above the tortured howling, the sound of laughing broke out. Deep, menacing laughter, hundreds of voices, echoed up into the air from the burning hole. Then, in one extinguishing squeeze, the ground swallowed the entirety of the fiery pit, leaving it completely covered in dirt, still and quiet. Soon after, and just like the pit of spears, the old church building caught in an instant and raging fire, quickly toppling the walls and dropping the steeple into its ruins. The smoke towered high in the night sky, which had just begun to hint at a pale morning blue. Smallmouth hung on his cross in utter horror and surprise.
As the late evening hours glowed into early morning, the smoke eventually tapered off as Smallmouth's drugs finally began to wear off as well. The fires of the church did garner long-distance attention, though. Just as Smallmouth was able to regain control of his muscles and voice, he heard emergency sirens call out into the cold morning air. Not long after, two fire trucks, an ambulance, and a sheriff's truck tore into the field and toward Smallmouth on the cross.
Not long after, Smallmouth could feel the tied ropes being cut loose by firemen, their uniforms easily the best red clothes he had seen all night.
"What on God's green earth happened here, son?"
A bearded man with a dark hat and brown shirt and pants asked Smallmouth once he had been lowered down from the cross and sat on the ground with a shock blanket around his shoulders. The sheriff, no doubt.
"God's green earth. It really is God's, isn't it?"
Smallmouth whispered, staring out across the cold field. Then, at the very place he was staring, an old, familiar truck came barreling out of the gravel road in the woods and through the field in the steadily growing morning light. It was Uncle Chuck's truck. It hurried over toward the other emergency vehicles, parked, the driver's side door burst open, and Uncle Chuck came bounding out over to Smallmouth, his eyes wide and his mouth a wonderfully shocked O.
"Jeremy! Jeremy!"
He basically fell on Smallmouth in a tight, warm hug. Smallmouth was caught off guard by Chuck using his real name. His uncle held him for several seconds and then let up, but kept his hands on Smallmouth's shoulders.
"I thought you were dead,"
both of them said at almost the exact same time.
"I came back and your house was a mess and there was blood everywhere. I thought you were dead,"
Smallmouth weakly spat out.
"Well, I woke up and you were gone, son, so I walked to the ranch to get my truck. I was worried about you, son. I came back home and the whole place had been turned upside down, blood on the carpet. I just thought the worst. Then I tried my neighbor's house. Buddy, they're dead. Looks like some wacko murder-suicide if I ever saw one. Scott probably tried to come kill us too and wrecked the place when found it empty. I don't know. But what I do know is that you are right here. You are okay, Jeremy. Praise Jesus."
"It's not that, Uncle. That isn't what happened out here.
Smallmouth's fried brain couldn't even comprehend what he had witnessed over the past few hours. It was all a violent blur.
"Don't worry about it, son. You can tell me everything on the way to the hospital. Gotta get you checked out and cleaned up. Come on."
He helped Smallmouth up, and they walked over to the ambulance, his uncle's arm thrown around his shoulder. Smallmouth would be sent home later that afternoon. It would take him and his uncle a long time to sort through the chaos of that deadly night and rebuild their lives. But life kept on. Smallmouth would remain living with his uncle and would begin a job working with him down at the ranch. Together, they started to attend a local church. Smallmouth never touched a drink or a drug or even a cigarette ever again and remained steadfast in his newly revitalized faith. You've been listening to Them Devils by Sam Morris. Sam Morris is a lifelong writer, just not in the usual sense. He was born to a musical family and has played piano and sang his entire life. He has also written songs for over 20 years. Having been a longtime horror fan, he first started writing short stories in 2022 and instantly loved it as a creative outlet, especially since it was so different from his usual world of music. Translating the art of songwriting into the form of short stories has proven very therapeutic to Sam, who must reach into the darker parts of his mind and exorcise the monsters that live there. Well, that was a rather uplifting ending, all things considered. The cultists are dead, the monster is slain, our hero is alive, and he's got a wonderful life in front of him. Outside of Scott and Scarlett getting butchered in their house, I'd say this is a net positive. Now I'm wondering when the other shoe is going to drop. Paranoia aside, I'd like to thank you all for joining me tonight, and I'd also like to extend my thanks to Sam Morris for the story this evening. Be sure to come back next week for another episode of Horror Hill. And until then, friends, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights.
Tonight's episode was hosted and narrated by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Original music provided by Eric Peabody and Nikki McSorley. Finalization by Eric Peabody and Craig Groshek. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at natalie@chillingtalesfordarknights.com to have your work considered for future production. Seeing as how we're all living in a technological nightmare of our own devising, I'll ask you to follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. Not only will you have appeased the dark gods of cyberspace, but you'll be kept in the loop as we prepare more terrifying content. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend becoming a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Otis Gyre's Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, Paul J. McSorley's Fear from the Heartland, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. As for me personally, I'm on most social media as Viking Guitar or Viking Guitar Productions. I'm always on the lookout for new stories to narrate and new music projects to mix or master. If that's of interest to you, feel free to reach out and we can talk turkey. Also, I will be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.